In the Cave, and David Politis has me on the edge of my chair as we talk about missing people. Missing 411 is his work. Unbelievable stuff. We'll be back in a moment with David on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Politis with us. So, David, the park workers who are there, obviously they know about the disappearances, but then what did they say about what they think might be going on? Do they reveal that to you?
Never. And I might say, George, that they know that the disappearances are happening, but you have to understand that unless you have this view from 50,000 feet, it's just an isolated disappearance.
Yeah.
And the way these disappearances happen is they don't happen annually. These disappearances happen maybe once every 12 to 15 years. And in the books, I write about this, and I say it's almost as though there's an entire circulation of people going through that park in that period of time, and very few have the opportunity to see multiple, unless you're in a place like Yosemite.
So are you saying that there's like multiple disappearances, but they only occur at a certain time frame?
They only replicate themselves at that location in 12 to, say, 16-year increments on norm. But there are these special places where they have a cluster of disappearance suddenly. As an example, Great Smoky Mountain National Park, they had three disappearances within, say, a 12-year time span, then it all stopped. And of those three, none of the people were ever found. So that's one of those unusual blimps on the radar screen, and then it's over. But you said something right before the break that I wanted to address, and that was animal attacks in conjunction with the disappearance.
Yeah.
Now, when search and rescue people go in there, they're looking for something like this. And if they see cougar tracks or bear tracks in that vicinity, they bring in a professional tracker, and they bring in a canine that's there to track that specific animal.
Okay.
If there's some conjecture that the person might have been abducted by an animal or something, we exclude the case. So search and rescue people have to come back with a determination that there were no alpha animals in that area to take out a human, and animal predation wasn't one of the issues that they were looking into.
The law enforcement agencies that are handling these disappearances, are they seeing a connection or a pattern here?
Nobody does. And again, George, you got to understand that they're looking at it from this angle of their own little area. When you start to look at it, say, from a vast area, a cluster we've defined as anywhere from 50 to 75 mile radius, and in that cluster area, there could be multiple jurisdictions.
Right.
Missing people are one of the lowest end issues in any law enforcement agency. I hate to say it, but not many people care, and nobody wants
right.
to work that job.
You're really right. Now, tell me the significance of the clusters.
So the clusters have highlighted to us that there is a regional issue to the disappearances. Well, let's just take Crater Lake National Park. It's in southern Oregon, sits out there by itself. If no one's ever been there, it's got to be one of the most pristine spots in the world.
God's country.
Absolutely. Now, what's interesting about that is that there's a lot of huckleberries around Crater Lake, and they have four boys that have disappeared either inside the park or on the perimeter of the park that have never been found. And we're talking pretty young boys here, anywhere between the ages of 6 and 14. And
jeez.
And again, it's no one's going to talk about this. No one's going to want to put the connection together. And all of these disappearances initially in that 10 to 14 days, huge search, huge everything, then all of a sudden nothing.
Have there been any reports of past Native American legend or myths of disappearances?
Well, there you hit on something that a lot of people poo-poo and don't want to discuss. But, you see, I think that's an important part of the entire equation when you say you look at a place like Crater Lake. Crater Lake has a history with their local Modoc Native Americans as a location that was evil, and they weren't supposed to go there. And when you look back at the history of that lake, in the very, very early 1900s, there was a man named B.B. Bukowski who went into that lake in the winter because he wanted to photograph it as it's never been photographed before in that winter setting.
Yeah.
They ended up going in because he never came out, and they found a cave with all of his supplies in there. They found some of his camera lenses, but they never found him. And he is one of many photographers that have disappeared in the wild and never been found.
Boy, I hope they developed his film, because maybe he has a shot of whatever happened to himself.
Well, the interesting part of that is they found his lenses. They never found his camera.
Ah, the camera's gone. I can't wait to get into the possibilities with you here in a moment. Let's talk about some specific significant cases you've looked at, David. I'll give you the names because you've supplied me with the names of the people, and then you can elaborate on just who or what. Keith Parkins.
Okay, April 9th, 1952. Location is Ritter, Oregon, and that's somewhat in the northeast region of Oregon, about 40 miles northwest of Baker. Now, this boy, at 2 years old, was visiting his grandparents' ranch. Another indicator is that when kids are visiting a relative's house location in a rural setting, they seem to disappear at a far higher percentage than when they're at their own home. So he was there visiting. He disappears just around noontime, just afternoon, and a massive search. And I'll quote you exactly what the Lewiston Daily Record said. A little boy who ran and stumbled over a dozen miles in 19 hours was found unconscious this Thursday morning and is expected to recover. His mother said the boy has apparently forgotten his night of horror. His pants, she said, were torn to shreds, and he climbed through fences and brush in the mountains. He went over, end of the quote. He went over two mountain ranges and 12 miles in 19 hours for a two-year-old boy. Is that believable?
Unbelievable. No, it's not believable. He would have died. The elements would have killed him.
And they found him unconscious in a frozen-over creek bed. And his father later on in the article stated that his son must have ran nonstop through two mountain ranges to get to where he was found. Now, every search and rescue manual provided to search and rescue teams says a two-year-old boy missing in the mountains will be found 95% of the time in 2.8 miles from the point last seen, 75% of the time 0.4 miles or less from the point last seen. And this boy was 12 miles away, two mountain ranges.
Unbelievable.
So those are the kind of stories that really make you question, how is this occurring? Now, we saw it in a room, and when we got this report, what really stunned us, George, is why were searchers in that location looking for the boy?
Good question.
Yeah, it made no sense to us.
Good question. Is Keith Parkins alive today? Do we know?
He is alive, yes.
Were you able to get to him?
Again, it's one of those things that we won't do based on what the missing people have advised us.
Do we even know if he's okay or if he's lived a good life afterward?
Great question. All I know is that he survived the episode, and as of 4 or 5 years ago, he was still alive, supposedly.
Jimmy Duffy, what's his story?
Boy, this one happened in the Little Wenatchee Ridge near Wenatchee Lake, Washington. Again, one of the cluster areas and one of the absolute hot spots for disappearances. Jimmy was 2 years old. James and Carol Duffy went hunting with their daughter, who was 18 months old, Natalie, and Jimmy, 2 years, I think he was 28 months old. And what happened was that the parents put him in a camper in a clear-cut area, and they were deer hunting. And they were walking always in view of their camper with their rifles. What happened was that they walked behind some trees for like 15 seconds, they say, and they hear a scream. They run behind They run out from behind the trees. They look up the hill 150 yards, and they see the back door of the camper open, swinging open. They run up to the camper, and this is the part that is enlightening, to say the least. The cat inside the camper and Natalie are still asleep. Jimmy's gone.
Jimmy's gone.
The dad does the right thing. He starts looking in the clear cut in the dirt for tracks. He doesn't see any. They search for an hour and a half. They find nothing. They drive. They get a ranger, and out starts an all-out search. And they bring in everything. It was in Chelan County. And this went on for 5 days at a high pace and then at a lower pace for an additional 5 days. Now, Chelan County, or Chelan, depends how you want to pronounce it, the detectives focused on the mom and the dad for some reason. And I mean focused on them hard. And how do I know this? This is one of those times where we got the police report. And when we requested the report from the county sheriff, they didn't have it. And what they did is they went back into old microfiche in a storage room, and they rebuilt the case, got it back to us. They weren't even looking at this. This happened October 19th of 73. He wasn't on any database anywhere. So Chelan County contracts with Seattle Police to do polygraphs on Mr. and Mrs. Duffy, and they pass. The sheriffs apologize to him, and they start focusing again on the boy. The parents told him that just as they were behind the trees, they hear these odd screams. But they said that it doesn't make sense to us because the scream was so loud they heard it immediately, yet Natalie and the cats were never woke up.
Screams of a boy?
Well, they said that the screams were too loud for it to be their son.
Huh.
So Jimmy Duffy's never been found. Now, the question is, and this is important to us, is why didn't the cat wake up? Why didn't Natalie wake up? And what was the scream? And then once we started to look at Wenatchee Ridge and the Wenatchee Lake area, we started to see that there are a lot of people that have disappeared there under very, very weird circumstances that fit our profile.
That is strange. What's the case of Sammy Bohike?
Okay, Sammy was an autistic boy, and there's something else that we're going to come out with sometime in the next 2 or 3 months, and that is a list of people who have disappeared with some sort of disability. The disability could be physical, it could be mental.
But a disability nonetheless.
Correct.
Now, are they found, and is the disability then gone?
No. Sammy Belke, again, 6-year-old boy, autistic. He was with his father, and they went up to a place called Diamond Lake Resort outside of Crater Lake National Park. The next afternoon, they go to the lake. They have lunch in a restaurant. Detectives actually interview the waitress. Everything was copacetic. About 4 p.m., they drive through a turnout next to the lake called Cleetwood Cove. As Mr. Belke gets out of the car, Sammy gets out and runs up to this little berm next to the side of the road and waves to his dad, and they're both laughing. And all of a sudden, he turns, and he disappears over the berm. And Mr. Belke runs up to the berm, and he says it's within seconds, and his boy is gone. And there's a lot of big trees, Douglas fir, pine, but there's not a lot of low ground cover. There's not a lot of bushes, so it doesn't make a lot of sense. The Park Service expended $540,000 on a search that lasted 2 weeks. Sammy Belke was never found, and they didn't find any evidence of where he might be. They brought in tracking dogs. Nothing worked, and this is kind of a normal thing that keeps coming up. When you search for people, you find evidence. Maybe you find clothing that they're starting to strip off. Maybe you found where they urinated, where they defecated, but you found tracks in the dirt, etc. This case, they found nothing. And this is, again, one of those areas around the lake where there's four other boys between the ages of 6 and 14 that have disappeared and have never been found in the last 18 years.
Got to be one of the strangest stories, David, I've ever heard. Charles McCullough.
Now, here's one, again, at Crater Lake, that is just truly a mind blower. October 14th, 76, he was 19 years old. He lived in Virginia. He made a trip out to the western U.S. to check out all the national parks and kind of have a long break for a year of going to college.
And he was on the older end of the kids that disappeared.
Correct. He told his folks that he told them on the 13th that he was going to Crater Lake and he'd be out of there and he'd contact them on the 15th or the 16th. He went into the lake area, he got a ride in, people saw him looking around. He never called his parents back, and they called the Park Service. They did a very brief search, and they didn't find anything. What's interesting is, in October 14th, 76, there were 20-foot drifts of snow around the lake. It had snowed the previous couple days. It was a pretty tough area to get around. Now, in that area at that time, there were no snow machines allowed. You could bring in footwear to walk in the snow, but that would be it. Now, Mr. McCullough came out from Virginia twice to figure out what happened to his son. He was a real proactive dad. And it bothered him that they weren't finding anything of his son. And they were 90% certain at the time that he never left that area of the park in a car. And one of the trips to the park, he met with the rangers, and he gave them a list of items that his son would have been carrying in his backpack. And then that's the end of it. That was essentially the end of his participation. You fast forward to October 1976, and a law enforcement ranger working for the Park Service named Marion Jack. I met with him, one of the nicest men you'll ever meet. During the year, he's a science teacher at a junior high in Medford. And during the summer, for 25 years, he worked in Crater Lake as a law enforcement officer, and his family lived up there with him.
Okay.
And Marion knew all of the items that were in the pack. One day, Marion's in the office, and some backpackers come in, and they say that they found some items on some trees way in the backcountry. And they brought in a pack they found, and inside the pack was a Volkswagen key, just like Mr. McCullough had stated, that would be there. So Marion knew that Charles was somewhere in that area, but that they had to go out and find him. He and his partner rode in on horseback. He said it was a long trip into the Bybee Creek drainage. And I should stop here and say that one of the last things that Mr. McCullough did was he wrote a letter to his state senator at the time, Harry Byrd. He stated that he knew for a fact that his son had to have been abducted, and he wanted the FBI to become involved. Byrd said that he didn't have anything to prove it, and he couldn't ask the FBI to get involved, and he denied the request. Fast forward again. Marion and his partner go back into the backcountry. They start searching around, and they find a small creek right near where this location was they found the backpack. Creek goes into a dead-end valley. Creek's running a couple inches deep, and there's a giant 4-foot-thick Douglas fir tree down across the side of this valley. So as Marion goes in, I talked to him for an entire day. He was a great man. And he said that as he walked up on this Douglas fir tree, on one side, he saw small pieces of bones, no bigger than an inch by an inch, laying everywhere. There were hundreds of small pieces. He says he stepped over the top of this Douglas fir tree, and on the other side, he said, "Dave, imagine if you were standing up. You unbuckled your pants, you dropped them to your ankles, and you disappeared." And he goes, "Because that's exactly what I was looking at. I saw socks. I felt little bones in the socks. There were no boots.
Jeez.
There was a belt, and there was underwear, and that was about it."
Hold on, David. Much more to this story when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Incredible story. We'll take your phone calls next hour with David Politis as we talk about his work, Missing 411. I've got a few more questions and some more cases we'll talk about when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, to our special guest, David Politis. Let's get back to the Charles McCullough case again and explain again what the park Marion Jack was able to find. He found the clothes of Charles, but it was in a weird way. Tell me about that again.
So they walk up the valley. There's two rangers, enforcement rangers. They get up to this 4-foot Douglas fir tree that's laying on the ground. On the other side, he told me, he said, Dave, imagine if you're standing up, you unbuckle your pants, you unbutton your pants, you drop your zipper, and you push the pants down to your ankles. And he said, there are no boots, there's just socks, the open pants, the underwear, and that's it.
No blood, nothing like that.
He said there was one broken tibia bone in the right pant leg. He said that was the only thing there. He said there was no coat, and he made a special point, and this is a good one. He said, Dave, I've been on 100 death scenes in the park where bodies were found. And he goes, sometimes these bodies had been there for 50 or 60 years and somebody found them, and always with the bodies were shoes or boots. He goes, they don't blow away. They stay there. And he goes, this is one part that really bothered myself and the other enforcement ranger. The other part being is that they didn't find any big shoulder bones, nothing like that. They found part of a scapula and part of the skull on the other side. But all of the bones were as though something had made them into this 1-inch by 1-inch size. And he says, we agreed that we couldn't find the coat, we couldn't find the boots. And this boy had to have made it 14 miles into the woods with 20 feet of snow. They said it was too weird. They left the scene. They called the FBI, and they asked for an FBI evidence response team to respond and work the crime scene. They said they didn't know what happened, but it wasn't anything close to normal. We made a Freedom of Information Act. This is so typical of the Park Service. For the reports associated with this, they said that they didn't keep them that old, and they destroyed them. I told Marion about this, and he said that was impossible. He said he wrote himself 16 pages plus photographs, and he said they had to have had them. I showed him the response. He goes, that's just wrong. So he made him a Freedom of Information Act with the FBI because it was their evidence response team. They refused to supply the evidence response team report on that crime scene.
Jeez. David, can somebody live in that park area out there in the wilderness and not be found? Live there. You know, maybe they set up a little tent or something, and they just stay.
Well, I suppose it's possible, but you've got to remember that the Park Service uses satellite technology to track fires in the woods. And a lot of people don't know this, but if you don't have a permit for a fire in the woods and you start a fire, even with a little stove that emits a lot of heat, the heat technology on the satellite is going to find you, and they're going to send in a backcountry ranger to sight you.
Is it possible that you might be able to obtain the satellite video or footage and zoom in during a certain time period if it was going on during that time that we had satellites up there? Now, in this case, this was where back in 75, so we probably didn't have many satellites up there, if at all.
And probably with the cooperation level of the Park Service, they won't even give us a report. I doubt we're going to get any satellite tracking info out of them.
Yeah, that's true. All right, what's the case of Walter Gordon at the Yosemite?
So, leaving it with McCullough, remember his dad wrote a letter to a state senator saying he felt his son was abducted and asked for assistance. We go to Yosemite, July 20th, 54. Walter Gordon was a grad student at UC Berkeley working a summer job at Camp Curry. That's the desk clerk position in the bottom of the valley. On the morning of July 20th, he left and went for a hike up to Glacier Point by himself. Well, he never returned. And there was a short search, but not the kind of search you'd expect. Fast forward 3 months to October 9th, 1954. A man named Orvar Von Loss, he's 30 years old. He was also a graduate student from the University of California, Berkeley. He went there with his wife and family and was staying at the Awani Hotel on the valley floor. And during one of those days, he asked his wife to borrow some binoculars and said he was just going to go on a short 2-hour hike right around the valley and he'd be right back. He never came back. On two separate occasions on the Von Loss case, dogs tracked the scent to the base of Royal Arch Cliff behind the hotel. And it's just as it says, it's a giant cliff. Now, Orvar wasn't a climber. He didn't have any climbing gear. He was wearing shorts and a light shirt when he left. Why would the dogs track to the base of a cliff? Needless to say, they sent rangers up. They searched that area for a week. They found nothing. On October 11th, the chief ranger for the park made the following statement, and I'll quote it. It's difficult to understand how a man could get lost in the area where Loss disappeared because there are so many trails and roads through it, and park visitors frequently are going by it. Now, in a strange sort of way, both families found each other, and they compared notes and the similarities of the disappearance. They were both grad students at UC Berkeley, both with different majors, and they determined that the men didn't know each other. Well, they decided, because they knew their boys so well, that there is no way this was a voluntary disappearance and that something strange had happened. The families got together and they wrote a letter to President Eisenhower, and they asked for special warfare troops that worked the mountains to come in and help with the search for their boys, because in quoting the letter, nothing points to voluntary disappearance in either case. The men's fate may exist in remote corners of the National Preserve. Neither men were ever found. Now, this represents part of that equation that I talked about of people on both ends of the intellectual spectrum. We have people with mental disabilities, and we have people that are extremely brilliant that have disappeared.
It seems like they're just guys that disappear, or do any females disappear?
Again, in Yosemite, July 17th, 1981, near Tenaya Lake, 14-year-old Stacy Aris was on a horseback trip into an area called Sunrise High Sierra Camp at about a 9,200-foot elevation. That area is almost all granite. There's very few trees. And she backpacked in there on horseback with 11 other people. They got to the Sunrise High Sierra Camp. There's a series of five cabins there that people stay in for the night. She went in there, she changed, she came out, and she asked her dad if she could go with this 70-year-old man named Gerald Stewart and walk to this point about 50 feet away and take pictures with her camera. Again, a photographer.
Did she know who the 70-year-old guy was?
He was just one of the guys that were with him on the trip. He was a good man.
Okay.
And he went with her and just sat down on this rock. He wasn't going to walk far because he was so old.
Okay, nothing weird about him.
No.
Okay.
And the entire group at these cabins sees them go to this place. And, in fact, the ranch hand that was the guide saw him sit down, and Stacy was standing up. All of a sudden, she starts to walk down the hill into an area about 400 yards down at the bottom of the hill where there's this lake surrounded by trees. And she said to Gerald that she'd be back in a few minutes, just want to take a couple pictures of the lake. Well, after a while, she didn't come back, and nobody saw Gerald get up. He came back and told everybody. They walked down by the lake, and they found the lens cap from her camera right inside the tree line around the lake, and they never found Stacy again.
Jeez. And was old Gerald a suspect?
Never, because they knew he never moved. Everyone saw him just sitting there.
Okay, all right.
Now, on this case, I was living in Los Gatos at the time, a suburb of San Jose, and she disappeared from the town right next door to me, Saratoga. So I took a keen interest in this, and I asked the National Park Service for the case file under the Freedom of Information Act. And at this point, I had gotten about 20 cases from the National Park Service on missing people that were never found. I get a call back from the special agent inside Yosemite asking me why I wanted this case. I explained that I was just one of these people that was following missing people cases. I was interested
in them all.
Well, I didn't want to say that, but I explained that I lived in a town next to her. And this special agent, and I'll quote him, he said, "You'll never get this case." I said, "Well, why would you say that?" I was being really polite with the guy, just kind of common law enforcement, polite conversation, and he comes out with this. And I said, well, why would I never get it? And he says, you'll never get it. And I said, well, is it anything more than a missing person case? No. I said, are there any suspects? No. I said, has anybody looked in this case in 25 years? He goes, not the best I could tell. I said, then why wouldn't I get it? He goes, none of your business, but you'll never get it.
They know something, David. They've got to know something. And speaking of Davids, what about David Scott?
David Scott, on the east side of the Sierras and on the east side of Yosemite, just outside the park perimeter, there's a small little community called the Mono Village. And the Scott family went there on July 13th of 57. It's about 14 miles east of Bridgeport, if people know where that is. It's in the Hoover Wilderness, right on the perimeter, elevation 7,100 feet. They arrived on a Friday afternoon. And about 3 p.m. Saturday, David was, at 2 years old, is walking around the perimeter of their campsite. And they all of a sudden noticed that he's gone. And this is a very flat area with a small lake with huge mountains all the way around it. So they immediately go to the sheriff. He goes to the Marines. And within a very short period of time, there's hundreds of people looking. Well, it turns out that some bloodhounds from the city I was from, Los Gatos, were pretty well known in the world, and they went out to help search for the boy. And searchers had just covered this valley end to end and not found anything. Well, these dogs start walking up a trail that is almost straight up the side of this mountain next to where they were. And nobody can believe the dogs, but the handler says, hey, trust me, we're on to something here. So they get up to 2,500 feet up this zigzag switchback trail on the mountains, and they're looking back now down the mountain at the campsite where the boy disappeared from. And it's getting dark, and they decide, okay, it's too late. We got to go back. They go back. The next morning, they go back up, and they peek out at this mountain at about 3,000 feet above the valley at about 10,000 foot in elevation. And the dogs want to keep going. They go back down the other side of the mountain, and some Marines are now climbing up another mountain on the back side. Folks, remember, this boy is 2 years old. Mm. A Marine goes around a boulder on the other mountain, and he finds David Scott laying dead, no shoes, wearing one sock, and wearing a T-shirt with no pants. He'd climbed well over 3,000 feet, nearly straight up. The cause of death that the coroner pegged on it was dehydration and exposure. When the Marine was interviewed about the body and had he seen any marks or anything on the body, he stated, that's not my area to comment on. You need to talk to the sheriff. And our key on that is that if there was nothing, he probably would have said there was nothing.
Right, right. And they just all seem like they don't want to get involved.
Yes. So I want everybody to think about this because, George, you have kids, I have kids. Could your 2-year-old have made that trip?
No, there's no way. I'm not sure I could make the trip.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is those type of things that are in the book. And you think, well, those must be one in a million, but they're not, because we have recounted about 1,000 of these very, very unusual kind of disappearances that make no sense, that we don't think a small boy could do.
The case of David Legg.
So we go to the east coast of the United States, July 10th, 71, an area of Newcomb, New York, kind of just south of an area called the High Peaks in far northern New York. So this was, they were visiting a very wealthy relative that had an estate and a small lake. And David was there with relatives, and there was quite a group there. And he and his uncle were going to go with some other kids and for a hike. And David comes out, and at eight years old, he wasn't dressed appropriately, and his uncle told him to go back to the lodge and change. And the lodge was not that far away, and on the way back, he disappeared. And nobody could believe he disappeared, and it was very odd because it was such a short trip with other kids all around the area. Well, the owner of the estate was a financial man from New York, very, very wealthy. And he flew out a 20-man search and rescue team from California, along with a group of search and rescue dogs from Washington to help in the search for David. And this went all out. This was probably one of the most thorough searches I've ever chronicled. And at about the end of the first week of searching, a group of Green Berets from Fort Devens arrives.
Green Berets.
Green Berets. And this is only the second or third time I've ever researched Green Berets out searching. And on the other shows I've been on, I always say that I would like to talk to a Green Beret that participated on the trip or any Green Beret who has ever searched for anybody. Because the best I can tell, other than these cases I've cited, the Green Berets have never searched for anybody else. It's always National Guard. Now, the difference in this is that the Green Berets come from areas all over the United States, and the National Guard are always local people. Now, why would the Green Berets come into search? After past shows, I've gotten a series of responses, never from the Green Berets, but from relatives, saying flatly, the Green Berets do not search for missing people.
No, there's something else they're involved in. This is like a Hollywood movie, David.
It's a bizarre Hollywood movie.
It is.
So the dogs take off with everybody in tow, and they go up the west side of the High Peaks. And this is probably the most rugged area of New York, and not extremely high in elevation like you get on the West Coast, but 4,000 or 5,000 feet, but rough, rough area. And the dogs track for days up the west side. They go all the way north, and they go north of Lake Placid. Then they go around the east side of Lake Placid and come back down the other side. And the handler said they were on the scent. Well, they come down, they're going south now down the east side of Lake Placid, way outside the city limits, and they lose the scent in a swampy area. David Legg was never found. And that was 38 days, and the only thing they found was one possible fingerprint. Mm. Now, the question comes in, and I've been asked this 1,000 times, why would the Green Berets respond and not the National Guard?
Yes, exactly. And nobody had an answer for you.
Nobody's ever given me an answer. A lot of theories, but none. Now, on this case, and on a case involving Dennis Martin, where the other case where the Green Berets were involved, we filed Freedom of Information Act with the Army asking for the orders. And, George, it was the strangest thing. I didn't get a negative response. In 4 different requests on both cases, we never got any response.
It's like they just don't want to talk about it, David.
Correct.
Let's get into some of those theories. We'll go through a couple more cases when we come back, and then we'll get into the possible theories here, why these people are disappearing. Plus, we'll take your phone calls in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with David Politis. His website is CanAmMissing.com.